It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Scores killed in apparent ethnic sectarian attack in central Nigeria. Rains in South Sudan bring additional hardship for many war displaced. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Nigerian officials say gunmen have killed more than 100 people in attacks across three villages in central Kaduna State, an area where disputes over land, religion, and ethnicity often lead to violence. Police confirmed the raids by some 40 Fulani herdsmen armed with guns and machetes late Friday into early Saturday in the villages of Angwan Sankwai, Angwan Gata, and Chenshai. Hundreds have been killed in the past year in religiously divided central Nigeria, where rivalries between the cattle herding and largely Muslim Fulani people and the mostly Christian farmers help fuel the unrest. The violence has not been linked to the insurgency in the northeast by Boko Haram and Al-Qaeda linked group that wants to impose Sharia law across northern Nigeria. The United Nations says nearly 500,000 people in northern Nigeria have had to flee their homes amidst the Islamist insurgency that also threatens food security. Heather Murdoch reports on the views of the UN Human Rights Commissioner.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Navi Pillay says the insurgency in northeastern Nigeria has spilled across borders into neighboring West African countries, along with nearly 60,000 refugees.
With thousands of refugees fleeing from Nigeria and arms and fighters reportedly flowing across international borders in the other direction, this terrible conflict is no longer solely an internal matter.
She says Nigeria should broaden its counterterrorism strategy and work more closely with neighbors and the international community to stop the Islamist militant group known as Boko Haram. Inside Nigeria, she adds, farmers have abandoned their fields as they flee the insurgents, threatening food security in many areas. Human Rights Watch says 2014 so far may be the worst year of the insurgency. It says the group has killed 700 people in attacks on 40 villages this year, displacing hundreds of thousands of people. At least 25 women and girls have been kidnapped. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
Nigerian officials say at least 16 people were killed, the result of stampedes, when some 500,000 people were invited to apply for fewer than 5,000 government jobs. The Interior Minister said the deaths occurred at five locations Saturday, adding the lives were lost due to impatience. There's a high level of unemployment in Nigeria, especially among the young. 3 years ago, the unemployment rate stood at nearly 24%. The International Rescue Committee says early rains across South Sudan have created hazardous conditions for thousands made homeless by the country's conflict. VOA's Joe DiCapo reports.
IRC's South Sudan country director, Wendy Teuber, surveyed the UN-topping displacement camp, once filled with shelters made of plastic sheeting and bamboo sticks.
646 were destroyed in just 1 hour of that intense rain with the severe wind. The base holds 23,000 people. But if 1 hour of rain can do that kind of damage, that's a matter of time before hundreds more are losing their shelters.
About 8,000 people are living in flood conditions at the Tomping site. Teuber says at least 10,000 people should be moved from Tomping. The early rains are expected to spread soon from the Juba area to other parts of South Sudan. Some 200 kilometers north of Juba, there's concern about what might happen in Minkaman, in Awerio County in East Lake State. There are about 50,000 displaced people there, many sheltering under trees. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
A source quoted by the French press agency says the governor of Sudan's troubled North Darfur state survived an ambush after visiting a town briefly held by rebels. Osman Kabir, returning to the state capital Al-Fashir from the town of Mellet, about 50 kilometers to the north. The military says it controls the town. Some 115,000 have been displaced by a recent outbreak of violence between government forces and elements of the rebel Sudan Liberation Army. Reuters reports Malian authorities are holding one of the country's most wanted Islamist fighters after he surrendered to French troops. France has been pursuing Abu Dardar, leader of the Al-Qaeda-linked Movement for Unity and Jihad in West Africa, or MUJWA, since its offensive in northern Mali launched more than a year ago. The group blamed for an attack on a French nuclear company's uranium mine last year in northern Niger. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. You can find more by accessing our internet website. That address, once again, voanews.com.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Boate in Washington. Today is Monday, March 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A Liberian legislator wants President Sirleaf to come clean on an alleged $200 million payment to foreign lobbyists.
We will want to, you know, accept from the president his full cooperation, because if that does not happen, she will be compelled to live by the law and the constitution of Liberia. I mean, that's all we want from Her Excellency.
Bofal Chambers is a member of the Opposition Congress for Democratic Change. The Central African Republic government is considering an anti-Balaka disarmament plan. Sudan's president to meet more political leaders this week on the future of the country. And Uganda's Electoral Commission rejects accusations of bias.
You must go on the ground and get your own vote. You cannot blame your own failures on the part of the Electoral Commission. All we'll do is organize elections. People vote.
Jotam Taramwa is the spokesman for Uganda's Electoral Commission. A new report says Zimbabwe and other African countries lag behind in terms of respect for the rule of law and community care boosts treatment of mentally ill in developing countries. Those stories plus Mark Oman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has denied allegations that her government spent more than $200 million in lobbying fees to foreign firms in the United States. In a letter to the plenary of the Liberian House of Representatives, the president said it is preposterous for anyone to believe that her government could spend such amount, especially with its transparent and accountable financial system. Sirleaf said only the U.S. firm KRL lobbied for Liberia from 2007 to 2013 and was paid the total of a little over $368,000. But Representative Bofal Chambers from the Opposition Congress for Democratic Change, who last month asked the House of Representatives to launch an inquiry, says President Sirleaf should cooperate fully.
When we heard of such an alarming, you know, amount being used for lobbying on behalf of Liberia, we lifted it because there wasn't any such disclosure made to us as legislators. So we felt that, in order to have some veracity owing to such claim, there must be legislative inquests, some inquiry, some investigation must be held. And thankfully, the legislature has, endorsed our letter, our issue. So now a special committee has been set up, headed by the chairman on judiciary.
The president in her communication said that she's been told by the Ministry of State for Presidential Affairs that the only company that has done lobbying for Liberia was the firm KRL, which was paid a total amount of $52,000.
Yes.
I guess you don't seem to believe that.
No. Even if I think the communication from the president, she says from 2007, now she has not looked at 2006, which we discovered to be a kind of amount of $19 million plus. There's a $19.7 million that was spent for 2009 for lobbying and public relations. Now, she said 2007. Okay, she said at KRL. Okay, let's look at 2007 from the documents we have. From the documents we have a JWI. It's one group that did lobbying, public relations for Liberia. And the amount spent was $31,933.38. The next one is LISCA. LISCA is for lobbying. It's $6.5 million. And then the other one besides LISCA is Clara, Gottlieb, Stern, and Hamilton. And the amount spent at that time, 2007, was the amount of $228,933.70. So we want the president, as I've always stated, to be clear, come forth, and tell us what she knows.
What I know is that most governments do hire the services of lobbyists, foreign lobbyists, to do their work. Why is this of concern when it comes to Liberia for you and the other members of the Liberian legislature?
Well, one of those things is that we have gross deficits in Liberia in terms of infrastructure at home, in terms of employment, in terms of welfare. There are so much gaps, huge gaps. and our people cannot afford. Internationally, we hear so much good things about our president, and this president of ours has got more accolades than the Pope of the Catholic Church, has got more accolades than the president of the United States. And yet, there's nothing that we can show for to say that because this amount was used, this is what we are seeing in Liberia. So that is why we are concerned. When so much is alleged to be spent for these kinds of exercises, what is the value for the money?
Bofal's Chambers is a member of the Liberia House of Representatives from the Opposition Congress for Democratic Change. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. The spokesman for Uganda's Electoral Commission has rejected criticism that the electoral body is not capable of organizing and administering credible, free and fair elections. Several opposition parties and civil society groups say votes are a selection to ensure President Yoweri Museveni remains in power in spite of his unpopular administration. But spokesman Jotam Taremwa tells reporter Peter Clarty the opposition groups should help the electoral process and stop tarnishing the reputation of the electoral body.
What incompetence are they talking about? We have organized general elections, referendum, and everybody has participated in those elections. Why can't they point out areas of incompetence? That is absolutely not true. And everybody, every right-thinking person should completely ignore those comments from the opposition and those members of the civil society who believe in that talk.
They are saying the elections organized by the Electoral Commission are basically a selection,
yes,
and that you know, especially when it comes to presidential elections, knows who is going to win, and that is President Museveni. So President Museveni has already been chosen as a legitimate leader even before elections. What do you say to that?
What scares me that as Electoral Commission we nominate a president, we don't elect him, because the president of the Republic of Uganda is elected on the same day the members of parliament are elected. How come they credit us when we conduct elections for members of parliament, but they discredit us when we conduct elections for the president? Yet the same presiding officer, the same time when you vote for the president, you move to the next and vote for the member of parliament. Where is the difference? We don't use different presiding officers for the two offices, president and parliament.
Has the Electoral Commission created a platform where concerns of the opposition groups, as well as perhaps the ruling party and other civil society groups, are addressed in future elections?
We have, first of all, in May of this year, we launched the 5-year strategic plan for the Electoral Commission, which had the three-year roadmap for the general election. Before that strategic plan, we had consultative meetings with the leaders of political parties in this country. The moment we came up with the strategic plan, we invited all those stakeholders and we gave them a program for the general election 3 years in advance, a program that came out of consultations with them. They have not complained anything on the program. All they do is go out in the media, punch our name. They don't tell us areas where they need improvement. How can we improve our methods of work without their input? The only input we do is incompetence and able to organize free and fair elections. Where do you base that assertion?
How do you win the confidence of opposition groups? Because you know this is not the first time such criticisms are being leveled against the Electoral Commission of incompetence and failure to organize credible elections.
I think they are missing the point. They cannot really focus on Electoral Commission and label it as incompetent. Can we deliver votes we don't have from the field? Can we deliver votes for the president? Can we deliver votes for the opposition? You must go on the ground and get your own votes. You cannot blame your own failures on the part of Electoral Commission. All we will do is organize elections. People vote in the open. At the end of the day, we count. Whoever gets less and the other one gets more, the other one wins.
Jotam Taremwa is the spokesman for Uganda's Electoral Commission. He spoke with reporter Peter Clarty from the capital, Kampala. It's Monday morning, March 17th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 14 and a half minutes past the hour. Sudan's Minister of Information says President Omar al-Bashir is expected to meet this week with more political leaders as part of consultations to activate a national dialogue on the future of the country, which the president announced in January. Last Friday, President Bashir met with Hassan al-Turabi, leader of the Islamist opposition Popular Congress Party. Information Minister Ahmed Bilal tells me President Bashir is serious about the dialogue on the political and economic future of the country, including even the role of religion in politics in Sudan.
Actually, the president met Sadiq al-Mahdi, the opposition leader before, Ummah Party leader, last week. And he's going to meet the others, the Communist Party and all the leaders of the opposition as well, as well as the leaders of the governing parties which are participating in the government. The talk is actually about how to reach a roadmap for the solution of all the problems of the Sudan. Political, economical, and social, and even about the association between the religion and the politics. All this is going to be discussed, and what we reach about is going to be adopted by the president and by the governing party.
Your critics say that since he announced this dialogue, the president is not very serious about carrying it through. So how serious is President Bashir?
He is very serious. A lot of homework has been done already, and I assure you the president is very serious. The leading party, the NCM, is also very serious, and we are very optimistic that we could reach some sort of consensus how to lead the country and how to reach consensus about the constitution and about the next election, how to be. Even transitional government can be also one of the items which can be discussed and agreed upon.
What does that mean, even transitional government? Does that mean that President Omar al-Bashir will form a coalition government with some members of the opposition?
No, not that. Actually, a scenario very similar to that one happened in Tunisia is going to happen in Sudan. What happened in Tunisia is that the governing parties as well as the opposition parties together, they reach a consensus about the constitution and about a program for a transitional government. Then all they agreed about it and they made a government which does not actually from this party or that. It is a technocrat government which is going to lead Tunisia for 1 year and to prepare for the elections. This will happen in Sudan as well also. We'll do that. We'll agree about all the items, especially how to reach peace and stability in Sudan, then the economical situation, all these and the reforms and political reforms and these things. If we agree about, then a transitional government is going to be constituted.
Ahmed Bilal is Sudan's Minister of Information. He spoke with me from the capital, Khartoum. The World Justice Project has just released its 2014 Rule of Law Index, indicating Zimbabwe is one of the African countries lagging behind in terms of respecting the implementation of the rule of law. The WJP Index measures how the rule of law is experienced in everyday life in 99 countries around the globe. Adherence is assessed using 47 indicators organized around 8 themes, including constraint on government powers, absence of corruption, open government, fundamental rights, order and security. Senior researcher Dewa Mavinga of Human Rights Watch says he is not surprised by the World Justice Project's findings on Zimbabwe.
There is no surprise at all on that front. Successive elections in Zimbabwe have not resulted in a paradigm shift in terms of the promotion of the rule of law and in terms of ensuring human rights respect across the country. What we have had have been choiceless elections that do not result in political change in terms of what direction the country should be going in. There is absolutely no political will in Zimbabwe to prioritize human rights respect, to prioritize good governance, to prioritize good economic governance for equitable justice for all the people in the country.
What can be done by all political players in Zimbabwe to make sure that the rule of law is respected as is being raised in that rule of law index?
The buck stops at President Mugabe's door. He must take decisive leadership in terms of moving the country away from dictatorship and prioritize the interests of the people of Zimbabwe. That is quite critical. And also, within political parties, within government, there is need for leadership renewal to ensure that there is the emergence of new ideas, new leaders with a new focus and drive and compassion for the people of Zimbabwe. These things must be in place for us to enjoy our basic rights as well as to enjoy the benefits of transparency, accountability and good governance.
The report singles out Ghana and Botswana as some of the countries or the only two top countries in Africa in terms of respecting the rule of law. What sets the two countries apart from the others?
Well, on the political front, you have clear leadership renewal. You have had political parties that change their leadership. But more importantly, there is transparency and accountability in terms of the use of resources. If you look at Botswana, it is endowed with massive diamond resources, the same with Zimbabwe. But the difference is in how those resources are used for the benefit of the people. The people of citizens of Botswana receive grants and things like that, which is really not happening in Zimbabwe, where people are heavily taxed and there is loot and plunder of national resources by a few individuals who are aligned to ZANU-PF mainly.
Dewa Mavinga is a senior researcher with Human Rights Watch. He spoke with Sandra Nyaira of VOA Zimbabwe program. The government of the Central African Republic is said to be considering a plan to persuade anti-Balaka militia fighters to leave the capital Bangui and return to their villages. But international peacekeeping chiefs are skeptical about a proposal that might leave them in charge of large camps full of combatants. Nick Long reports for VOA from Bangui.
Both the Seleka rebels who overthrew the president last year and the anti-Balaka militias that drove back the Seleka are accused of massacring thousands of people and of widespread looting and destruction. At least 100,000 Muslims have fled the Western CAR in recent months as a result of sectarian violence led by the anti-Balaka. Some of the anti-Balaka in Bangui came from the provinces late last year, seeking revenge on the Seleka or perhaps just wanting to loot the capital. The government wants to help them go home. One government minister told VOA that anti-Balaka seeking to leave will need transportation and farm tools. And an anti-Balaka coordinator who advises the government said there is a plan to find a place where the anti-Balaka can gather before going home. Gilbert Kamizulai says he commands the anti-Balaka militia in southern Bangui. He says he has asked that his group be immediately put in camps, then demobilized and helped to rejoin civilian life. And he says they should receive amnesty. The papers are with the government, he says, but it's taking time and they find themselves still in the field. The plan will probably involve international aid donors. It will also likely involve the French and African Union peacekeeping missions to protect the demobilized militia. French Commander General Francisco Soriano said this week he has concerns about the idea of putting the anti-Balaka in camps. As for the anti-Balaka, he asks, who are they and who is their chief? He says he doesn't know. If people are to be put in camps or cantons, says Soriano, there needs to be a clear chain of command and a chief who has authority over them. There is also the risk that a huge number of people could turn up at a camp and wait there for months and then decide not to leave after all. Some Seleka fighters have been cantoned in Bangui, but Soriano says that was possible because they have a chain of command and are identifiable. Nick Long for VOA News, Bangui.
Experts say less than 10% of people with mental illness in low-income countries receive treatment. As VOA's Jessica Berman reports, a new study shows community-based care is an effective strategy for treating individuals with schizophrenia.
Researchers found the most successful way to treat people with mental illness in resource-poor countries is for the care to come to them. In the first rigorous trial of community-based care for the mentally ill, researchers looked at the benefits of home visits at three sites in India, comparing the outcomes to those who received their care exclusively from mental health clinics. The study involves schizophrenic patients ages 16 to 60. A professor of community psychiatry at the Institute of Psychiatry at King's College London, Graham Thornycroft, led the study.
So what we wanted to do in this study is to find out, can we develop a relatively simple and affordable type of treatment that will increase the number of people who get treatment and increase the quality of care?
Thornycroft says trained healthcare workers visited the homes of 187 schizophrenic patients, making sure they took their antipsychotic medicine regularly and educating family members on how to care for loved ones with mental illness. The patients also visited mental health clinics for professional care. Their progress was compared to that of 95 patients who received their care exclusively at mental health facilities. A year later, Thornycroft says, researchers noted a significant improvement among patients who'd been visited regularly by healthcare workers.
For example, voices or delusions were less in the community treatment option. Secondly, the levels of disability were lower when people had community care as well as the medical treatment. And third, people were more often likely to take their medication if they had the close support of coming to visit their homes rather than getting no follow-up between the doctor's visits.
In a study published in the journal The Lancet, researchers noted community intervention was more expensive than clinical care alone. But Thornycroft says this has to be weighed against the enormous social costs of not treating individuals with schizophrenia and other debilitating mental conditions. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Nigeria pipped China 2-1 at the start of their Group D campaign at the FIFA Women's Under-17 World Cup in Alajuela, Costa Rica on Sunday. Early on Saturday, bronze medalists Ghana beat North Korea 2-0 in Group B action in Liberia, while tournament debutants Zambia lost 2-0 to Italy in their Group A tie in the capital, San Jose. Turning to athletics, world junior cross-country champion Faith Chepngetich Kipyegon led a 1-2-3-4 Kenyan sweep of the senior women's 8-kilometer race at the 4th Africa Cross-Country Championships in Kampala, Uganda on Sunday. World junior cross-country championship silver medalist Leonard Barsoton comfortably won the senior men's 12-kilometer race in which Kenya claimed the top 5 places. Earlier on, Kenyans Moses Mukono and Agnes Tirop prevailed in the junior men's 8 kilometers and junior women's 6 kilometers respectively. The only non-Kenyan individual medalists were Eritrean bronze medalist Afewoki Behane in the junior men's race and Ethiopian silver medalist Alemiru Heroye in the junior women's contest. Kenya retained all 4 team titles. In the senior men's category, Uganda was second and Ethiopia third, while in the senior women's race, Ethiopia came second ahead of Uganda. Eritrea pipped Ethiopia for the silver medal in the junior men's contest as Ethiopia placed second and Uganda third in the junior women's event. In Portugal, Kenyan Olympic and World Championship 10,000-meter finalist Bedan Karoki triumphed in his debut at the half marathon in the Portuguese capital Lisbon on Sunday. Covering the distance in 59 minutes and 58 seconds, Karoki is the only athlete to complete the course in under 1 hour. He was followed across the finish line by fellow Kenyans Silas Kibruto, Ezekiel Chebi, then Eritrean Tekle Mariam Mehdin. Meanwhile, Ethiopian Werknesh Degefa clocked 1 hour 8 minutes and 46 seconds to win the women's race. Kenyan Jemima Jelagat was 2 seconds adrift, while another Kenyan Flomena Chepchirchir was third. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. The mail for this Monday morning comes from Ambrose Agio of Makurdi in Benin State, Nigeria. He says, "Dear VOA, I think the ongoing palaver over Ukraine can be compared to a quarrel between a new courtship and a desperate divorced polygamist. While the U.S. and partners have apparently gained new grounds in their marriage overture, President Vladimir Putin and his administration are quick to bedride a referendum for the return of fellow ethnic folks to their fold." We thank you, Ambrose Agio of Makurdi in Benin State, Nigeria, for your comment. And please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. That's it for this Monday, March 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Butter saying, have a lovely day.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.